Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wandering Road Podcast. I'm your host Chris, alongside my co-host Dean, and today guest hosting with us is a familiar voice, JJ from Southern Demonology. And for today's episode, it's going to be our Halloween special. So we're going to talk about the origins of Halloween and wherever the conversation takes us with regards to Halloween and maybe some demonic stuff, we'll see. And before we get started with today's show, if you would like to share your stories with us or be on the show as a guest, please submit your story to us at our email address, which is twroadpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We would love to speak to you guys. So if you want us to feature your story in an episode, so that's hauntings, whatever you've experienced, any cryptid encounters, alien encounters, ghost encounters, we'd love to hear from y'all. And the email address is twroadpodcast@gmail.com. How are you doing tonight, guys?
How about you, JJ?
Tired. It has been a hell of a week.
No, I hear you guys. The lovely world of IT, right? Project management and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, I was flipping between projects today, updating container definitions, revamping front-end websites, building Python back-end retrofit scripts. It was kind of all over the map this entire week. So
sounds like a bunch of shit I wouldn't want to do. But.
I enjoy it. Part of my work is really kind of leading customers to correct paths and helping them establish their own processes, in addition to being kind of like individual contributor and hands-on keyboard. So it's a nice blend of consulting and actual IC work. But
let's dive right into it, guys, now that we've gotten our work grievances out the way. I'm sure I feel a lot better. Halloween. Aside from the trick-or-treating and all that costume jazz, what do you guys know about it? I'll go ahead and start with you, JJ.
Probably more than any sane person would ever want to.
Oh, good. I was worried because I don't have anything, man. You lead.
It's an interesting blend. Because you have the tradition of All Hallows Eve, or All Saints Eve, which is a celebration of the past martyrs and saints in which the church recognizes. And then you also have, you know, a lot of conjecture that this is an blending and more than likely an appropriation of the church of more Celtic and Gaelic holidays known as Samhain, or most people just pronounce it here because they don't know, Samhain. And there's some interesting kind of blends from the two of those, but I'll leave it there. I'll let y'all continue because I don't want to dominate this conversation by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, in my research up front, I will say that I was going to say Samhain, but Samhain, or how did you pronounce it again? What was the original pronunciation? Samhain. Yeah, Samhain. I feel like I've heard that before. So that was originally celebrated on like around the end of October, I think October 31st exactly, based off of some of my research. But like you said, it came from the declaration of like kind of an All Saints sort of day, like an All Hallows Eve kind of spectacle. But you said there's some overlap across the globe, which I find fascinating. And I just actually just watched, we have a young kid, and we just watched Coco, which they, in that movie, Coco is a Disney Pixar movie. They talk about the Day of the Dead. And Chris, you grew up in a Hispanic culture. So like, can you talk about the Day of the Dead at all? Is there any overlap to what you see in modern day Halloween?
I'm not Mexican.
Oh shit. Sorry, man. Is that Mexican? No, I thought that was okay. All right, guys, I'm going to get off now. Okay. You guys have a good night. Later.
Dude, I would have made that mistake 100,000 times. I can't say a damn thing.
That's what I get for trying to freestyle, man. I'm just like looking at my notes, like trying to go off and just riff, and it's not working at all. Let's pick it up in 3, 2, 1. Okay. No, okay, here is something that I know I can talk about because I'm not going to look like an asshole talking about it by accident. One thing I came across in my research is the spectacle of Halloween in America kind of started when I think it was even after the Pilgrims came, but it was basically like the Irish and the Scottish who came over to the U.S. in I think the early 1800s or so. They brought with them this concept of carving vegetables to ward off evil spirits. And I think that there's some like really cool avenues that can be discussed there because there are so many cultures across the globe completely separate from this Halloween vein where they create these carvings or whatever it's made out of, wood, vegetable, food, anything, to ward off evil spirits. And this kind of like ballooned into this idea in America that we can carve jack-o'-lanterns and pumpkins and whatnot. So do you guys have anything to like talk about with that aspect, with like warding off evil spirits and carving pumpkins or vegetables or anything like that?
Yeah. So it actually started off in Ireland by carving turnips, believe it or not. And then once it kind of migrated its way over into the Americas, they chose the native kind of fauna, which would be a jack-o'-lantern. And you actually have the interesting folktale of Jack, who trapped the devil.
We were just talking about this folktale.
It's so fun. The Jack tricks dares the devil to climb a tree. He does so. He carves a cross at the bottom of it so he can't get back down. And then says that the devil can never take his soul. And so the devil agrees, and he lives a life of debauchery and sin. And as a result, when he dies, he can't get into heaven. The devil refuses to take him because of the deal. And then he launches a spit of fire from the depths of hell to Jack. He dodges it, but he preserves that little spark in a gourd. And that is the jack-o'-lantern. And they now wander the earth looking for a place to rest for all eternity.
That is so fascinating because in my research, and I believe your story, like before I would say anything about what I've done for my research, but in the research I've done, it's exactly the same, except the story goes that he was in a bar, and maybe you've heard this rendition, but he was in a bar and the devil came into the bar and they were drinking together and the devil revealed himself to Stingy Jack. And Jack convinced the devil to turn into a coin to pay for their drinks. But instead of spending the coin, he kept it near like a rosary or some like silver cross in his pocket. And then the devil couldn't change back into the devil from being a coin. So eventually Stingy Jack cut the same deal you were talking about where it's like, oh, I'll let you free. I'll let you come out if you agree to never take my soul. But you added that extra bit about, you know, the spitting of the flame from hell and like lighting the jack-o'-lantern. I thought that was really, really cool. Interestingly enough, as much as I know about Halloween and growing up around that kind of mentality and that process as a kid, I never, ever heard this story. So it's just really weird how things kind of just fall off the map in terms of like the history of Halloween.
Oh, yeah. And I'd never heard that rendition that you just spoke about. So that is, but I mean, there's a rich history of tricking the devil that kind of grew out of all of the Dark Age grimoires that kind of began, you know, that were popular. In fact, one of the popes was reputed to be a black sorcerer and deal with all this stuff. So yeah, it's always such fun times to talk about this
stuff. So we know that in the past, the reason that they carved jack-o'-lanterns or the turnips or on vegetables and whatnot was to ward off evil spirits. Now, where did that concept come from? I always wondered.
Well, you've got two sides of the coin. You have the church traditions in which it grew out of an idea that you wanted to honor the dead. And then it kind of morphed into this idea of, Well, we're actually trying to remember the souls of the dead. And then that kind of morphed into, well, all people that died during the year, they remain until Halloween. And it's then that they have a chance to get vengeance upon their enemies before they then move on to the next world. And then it morphed again into, well, really, it's more about celebrating purgatory. And you have this idea of soul cakes, in which households that could afford it, they would bake these bakeries, and then they would hand out these soul cakes to people that would in turn worship or pray at their doors. And then they would eat the soul cakes as they were a stand-in for the soul itself. That's the church side. But then on the Gaelic side, especially the Scot-Irish, you had this idea that, you know, this happened on one of the half days of the Gaelic calendar. It always happened usually either on the 31st or November 1st, depending upon how you calculate it time. And it was to mark the end of the bright season and entering into the luminal phase of the darker half of the year. And it was a time in which fae and spirits could very well become much more active. And whether you cast fae as their own kind of unique, you know, spirits, or if you cast them as ancient gods who had been forgotten and are now in these twisted, horrible forms. Either way, you know, it kind of mirrored to the same thing. And you would have elders who would dress in horrific garb in order to scare these things away. And then for the bonfires that would be lit at night, they would, you know, younger people would smear their face with the ash in order to then also intimidate and to scare these things away from their doorsteps. And then you also have an idea of, in addition to guising, this concept of households that could, again, afford it, would then offer food to the people that would come to their doors, and that would help to appease some of these deities that were out there. And it all kind of blended together. But I will say, at the end of the day, I think we all know that Christianity is the ultimate Absolutely. Opportunist when it comes to holidays. They will appropriate whatever they possibly could, because that was a very smart way of spreading itself across many different, you know, different traditions and histories. And it, yeah, and we get a hodgepodge of things now, but.
Right. Yeah. I always wondered about that, because it's like immediately right after Halloween is All Saints Day, where we all like, everybody prays for the saints. Yeah. Like we're gonna go, pray for the dead and visit cemeteries. So it's like the church is like, we'll let you keep your pagan shit, but this is what it's really about. It's about the saints.
Mardi Gras?
Yep. Even in like the 15th century, you had hugely negative reactions to the traditions that were being established for All Saints Day and for Halloween. The Protestants would sit there and complain that, oh my gosh, what you're doing is, you know, devilry. You're actively conjuring up the devil, and they would outlaw it in certain parishes. And, it, you know, you always have this tension of any, I hate to quote it, but when you have Paul who says those who are strong in faith and those who are weak in faith, and typically in Christianity, you have those who are weak in faith tend to dictate the policies and be much
You hear that, Protestants? I'm kidding.
No. This goes for, it doesn't matter what walk of faith you are. It's a universal We're only human kidding. Experience, I think.
JJ, this is what I'm talking about. Like having someone like you on who has just a depth of all this understanding, you just opened up so many cans of worms that I want to touch on, but I won't touch on all of them. I'll save some of them for later. But the one thing, like kind of a side joke, just like you were saying how like, oh, if you could afford it, you could do something that would save or protect your family from evil spirits. It's like, oh, the rich get all the breaks. Goddamn, they always get all the breaks. If you're poor, you're just going to get cursed and, you know, screwed over more and more. Which, you know, I got to wonder if there's something to that with the whole like debt trap concept of like people who are like really indebted or they're just really poor. It's just this cyclical. It's just really difficult to escape out of. So that's very interesting that we'll save for another day. But the one thing I wanted to bring up that I'll choose to bring up from this whole conversation or everything you brought up, this idea that the church will take something, or the Catholic Church will take something, or I guess it could be anybody. It could be any religion, I guess, based off of if you go back in history long enough time, like we were talking about Zoroastrianism and Hinduism kind of working off each other and whatever. But like the church took, say, the concept of the pagan goat god. And you can please correct me if I'm wrong, but like one thing that I remember learning a long time ago was they took this idea of the goat god with the horns and the hooves and whatnot. And in the pagan religion, like that god wasn't anything malevolent or evil. It was just like one of
the— Are you talking about Pan?
Deities. And, but that—
From the Greek Pan, god?
Something like that.
The satyr.
Yeah, oh, was it the Greek god? Sorry, the satyr. But like that kind of morphed into like what we see today in like modern depictions of the devil or some demon or something like that. It's like it has goat horns and it's got goat feet. And I was just wondering, like, can you finally put this to rest for me? Like, what is the history of that? Is that actually something that was borrowed to kind of like subjugate or lessen the impact of paganism back then? Or is that, am I completely off?
Oh, no, that actually has even more ancient roots than even— I mean, paganism wasn't even a glimmer in the eyes of its believers at that point, I believe. Now, of course, history has never been my absolute strongest suit, so you can correct me if I'm horribly wrong, which I probably am. But, you know, goats are such an alien-looking thing, especially in their eyes, and that has always ignited people's imaginations. It certainly has mine. But we find in Deuteronomy this concept of a ritual in which you cast your sins upon Azazel. And it's something about leading a goat into the desert. The thing is that this is one of the areas in which we have lost complete knowledge of what this passage is talking about. Is the goat named Azazel? Is Azazel a demon? Who knows? I will say that in the Hebrew Bible, you do have probably the only named demon is called a satyr, and it is directly an import and from Greek, a satyr. It is a goat type of thing. So this idea has been around forever. And in fact, you know, once Judaism was introduced to this idea of there should be an enemy for God, there is about 150 to 200 years of casting around for who this enemy is. And one of the early candidates was Azazel. And I know a lot of people would say, oh, no, that's not how you say that name. It's Azazel. Get it out of your head. This is not the right pronunciation. The movie Fallen is the worst piece of crap ever developed because they could not get the name of the demon right. Denzel, Azazel, Azazel. No, it is Azazel. And it follows a very simple pattern. An angel's name is a three-syllable word in which it is like Gabriel, Mikael. Gabriel means the mighty warrior of God. Mikael, who is like God. Azazel it's a parody of an angelic name because instead of Aleph Lameth at the end, like which is the word for God, you have Ayin Lameth, and that is, Ayin is kind of the inverse negative version of Aleph. So, it really just means the scapegoat. That is its literal translation. So, Anyway, I didn't mean to go on one of my rants, but that is one of my pet peeves when I hear people say Azazel. I'm like, oh, I just
Chris, that was like that one episode where I played for my wife, and I'm like, she's the one who pointed it out to me, but I had too many Martoonies on that particular day, and I could not say Incubus or Succubus right. And Chris corrected me like three times in like a minute. And my wife, we were driving in my car listening to that podcast with my wife, and she just looked at me dead eye, and she's like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" Like, goddamn. Oh my god, it's just like I could hear it too, and I'm like, I'm surprised you didn't cut that shit out, Chris.
No, it's too enjoyable. Like the whole Day of the Dead funny. Thing, Dia de los Muertos things. That's staying in here.
Oh, leave that shit in, man. Everyone's gonna know.
So, with regards to demons and the concept of Halloween in the Judeo-Christian concept, the modern like context of this, you know how they're always damning Halloween, saying, "Oh, this shouldn't be celebrated. You're welcoming Satan, the devil." Is that just a fairly modern concept, or is that something that has been prevalent for a while, do you guys think?
That's been prevalent since at least the 15th century. So there's nothing new in that idea. This whole idea of making hell houses in response to Halloween, I don't know about that. I don't care to look enough into that particular history, but the idea that, you know, all of this is of the devil, and if you participate, then you're damning yourself to hell. I'm sorry. I graduated from hellfire and brimstone speeches after leaving the Protestant church, so I don't pay too much attention to that anymore.
You know, one fascinating aspect as well with that whole concept of, you know, participating in Halloween is demonic or anything. I'd like to go back to the stories, JJ, that you were talking about with tricking the devil. Like, that was a really interesting concept that I have heard about in the past. And when I grew up in and around Christianity, and I think I told you guys this before, but like, I did delve into Christianity pretty deeply at one point in my life, because I figured when I was younger, I'm like, well, I grew up with it, I understand it, and I believe in it, so I might as well lean into it. So I really went in deep into Christianity for a short time in my life, and I met a lot of people who were way deeper than me, who were still very deep, which nothing wrong with that. But one interesting concept that I thought about back then was like, well, the devil is supposed to be able to manipulate us, and the devil can like send his minions or whatever and trick us into doing terrible things or tempt us or whatever. But this is probably getting way too like theological, philosophical, but the concept of the devil as being less than human in the sense that humans can trick him in these stories. And I understand they're just stories, but there is still probably some belief to them at whatever point that they came out of. Like some people believe them. I was always fascinated, even back then when I was leaning into Christianity with this idea that you could somehow trick the devil. And I remember one thought that I had during like a couple sermons at one point. I'm like, well, you know, we're supposed to ask for God's help and grace or whatever, whenever the devil is trying to trick us. And, you know, we want to do something we're not supposed to do. Or we're being tempted. We're supposed to pray to God to help us be released from that. But no one ever talks about convincing the devil that, hey, why are you doing? Hey, dude. Why are you doing this shit? You're fucking everybody. You're messing everything up. Like, you know, why don't you just come back to the side of good, and you can literally be you can fix everything. So that really goes down the road of like, does the devil have free will? Even if the devil wanted to, let's say hypothetically the devil was real, the devil has free will. The devil can make decisions and can get ensnared and trapped by like human tricks or whatever. That means the devil has free choice. So what would happen in a situation where the devil made the decision to let up, so to speak? I always thought that idea was fascinating, and maybe we could talk more about that with this idea that the devil can, you know, be tricked based off of some of these stories like Jack.
It's a good question. Before I launch into my tell, do you have anything, Chris, you wanted to jump in with?
I did, but Dean got me so ensnared in that, what he was saying about the devil asking for forgiveness. But the one thing that is always playing in my mind is pride. Look at how vain. I don't want to steal your thunder, JJ, if you're going to get into this as well. But look at how vain humanity is.
Oh, no, go ahead.
And how prideful we are. Even if you did something wrong, you know, deep down in your soul, you fucked up. You did something really wrong. Look at how hard it is for people to apologize. Perfect example. Look at a spouse being unfaithful to another spouse and they get caught red-handed. Most people will fucking try to gaslight the other person into thinking that it's their fault. It's just the pride element. And that's, for me, simplistically, that's the way that I view it as to why the devil would never ask for forgiveness. But I believe like there are always there's like some theological answer saying that even if he did try to beg for forgiveness, he wouldn't be forgiven based off of what he did. But I'll digress to you, JJ.
So I think a lot of the idea that you can trick the devil actually is inherited from Zoroastrianism. And I don't mean to keep barking up the same bloody tree, but in the text, in the Gethas, Ahriman, who is the enemy, is described as being slow-witted and not really understanding a whole lot. His main driving forces were hate and vengeance, and that was really about it. And I think that translates to where people viewed the devil as being somewhat stupid. And you don't find that so much nowadays, because especially if you put any credence into the idea of exorcism and possession, then these are forces that you never, ever, ever want to tangle with, ever. And there is no such thing as tricking. In fact, it's usually them tricking us into believing that we have no free will, so that they can gain entry into our psyche, our souls, however you want to phrase that. The other idea is kind of more common sense, in the fact that if someone is standing against God, then they can't be the brightest of all individuals, right?
Right.
You know, I think that the movie, now I know that you just recently saw this, Chris, Nefarious, had such a fantastic take on that intractability of changing positions. And I loved its description of that. I really did. It truly resounded. And I'm like, yeah, that's a very Milton kind of concept to espouse, but yeah, I could see that.
I actually have to wonder, in other religions, which I don't really know as much about in depth, like, you know, this idea that humanity is either more intelligent than they lead on to be, or they're just really, really dumb and they're really, really driven by their own emotions. That kind of ties back into what Chris was saying about how, you know, if we're smarter than the devil, like how could we possibly be tricked by the devil? But at the same time, like we can't escape from this idea, this carnal idea that we need to be prideful, which could, you know, could possibly, you could argue, is tied to like in our innate drivers of like, you know, needing to fit in. And having these requirements as human beings to fit into society and survive, not just survive, but thrive and rise above. So I think that the conversation is really at odds with like what humans are factually, like what aspects about us that we're not able to escape from. Like, for instance, like we can't not eat. I mean, that's a really simple analogy and it's kind of probably really too simple, but like, we can't not eat food or we'll die. But like, what about the psychological aspects of humanity? Like we can't not seek approval. We can't not seek social inclusion. So that, I mean, it kind of gets to like a Socratic argument, or like something that's really philosophical, where it's like, well, how much is too far on the spectrum of like one way or the other? So like brash, there's like brash and there's brazen, but in the middle, it's like heroic. So like which way, and I wonder how you can superimpose that to the idea of like, say, a demon or a devil, where some people think historically they were, you know, the devil was really, really dumb. But like you were just saying, during like modern exorcisms, you wouldn't want to tangle with demons and devils because they will try to trick you to even giving up your free will, or tricking you into thinking you don't have free will. So like, what, I wonder if there's like a sweet spot historically between multiple religions, but we don't have to touch other religions. We can even just focus on Christianity and in the guise of like Halloween or whatever. But like, I wonder what that happy medium is between the two. That might just be bullshit. I just was kind of riffing there.
No, it's not bullshit at all. Do you know the concept of a dialectic?
I've heard of that, but I'm not familiar exactly what that is. Can you explain?
So a dialectic are two polars that give meaning to each other and cannot be separated from each other as a result. For example, Karl Barth, who's probably one of the three great Protestant theologians of the 20th century, alongside Rudolf Bultmann and Paulus Tillich. And by the way, Paulus Tillich was the biggest horn dog pervert. He was infamous for this stuff, even to the point of cheating on his wife on their wedding night, of all things. But Barth, in his epistle to the Romans, I don't think it was the Church Dogmatics, although it could have been. But anyway, in the Epistle to the Romans, he writes about this concept that you have those things that belong to the divine, and then they are weakly reflected on earth as lesser things. So you have a church on earth, but you have the divine church in heaven. You have justice on earth, but then you have true morality in heaven. And, you know, these things mirror each other. It's just that ours is a much weaker sauce version than what you find undiluted in heaven. And then you have the inverse of all of that that would appear in hell. I've heard it described that by some exorcists that demons, when they were stripped away from God, they still had that inbuilt need for communion, of singing the praises of something. But it was horribly, horribly twisted to the point where now they're not singing praises, but they are communing with humanity in order to corruptify and to filthify them. I don't even know if those two are words or not, but you have to forgive my vocabulary in this case. That could very well be true, but I mean, you find that need to commune within us. I mean, we are social animals, and I think a lot of us felt that pain during the pandemic, being walled away, not being able to participate in social life, and things definitely took a turn for the worse, and we're still feeling
introvert,
the after effects
so
of all of that.
I fucking hate people. I enjoyed not having anyone on the roads at all. But I did want to say, like, the concept that you brought up of, like, I might be butchering this, basically our humanly existence, our earthly realm, is a significantly weaker version of what happens in heaven. Is that assessment incorrect? So humor me this.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it.
Is there Halloween in heaven then? By that assessment? I'm not trying to be a smart ass, but
No. Okay.
They're definitely not a one-to-one parody. I will put it that way. It's more of the concepts themselves you'll find mirrored in heaven as it is on earth, but just here it is much more diluted, prone to error.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Prone to
misjudgment. Hey, but as long as St. Michael's making some kick-ass pizza, I think I'll be good. That's all I ask. That's all I ask. Please have pizza.
this is what fascinates me about the concept of heaven and hell and all this conversation. And this could literally, like, what I'm about to bring up could be a whole other podcast for real. So feel free to just touch on it. But this idea, like, going back to my concept of, like, back when I was really delving into Christianity and stuff like that, learning about it and really believing in it and stuff, like, in addition to the question about the devil that I brought up earlier, another thing that I thought about during that time was like, well, and I know, like, you know, this is probably not the real rendition of heaven that actually exists. If there is a heaven, it's not exactly, you know, rain, like it's not rainbows and clouds and people strumming harps and stuff like that. That's just, you know, it's, there's something way beyond that we could possibly imagine as heaven. But one thing that fascinated me about the idea of heaven that people talk about on earth is that, like, you're still yourself. You still reside within your own psychological makeup, except you just don't have any hangups of like the temptation of evil or whatever. So if, you know, like say Chris and I, like we're big nerd gamers. Like we like to play video games. However, 100 years ago, people our age were toiling on average, like in some kind of, you know, terrible factory or something. There were no fucking games. You know, maybe they drank alcohol. They had some fun that way, but maybe they rolled some dice or something, but there was no video games. There was no pizza to the way we describe it today. So like when you get to heaven, does every generation in heaven just have like a new, like whatever they experience? But then at the same time, if it is heaven, you get to experience other people who lived before you. You're in the same communal environment. So do the people who never got to experience video games and pizza like 100, 200, like 1,000 years ago, do they get to experience that too? Like what happens when you go to talk to them and commune with them and you get to do what you like to do? Will they be curious about it? Will they even understand it? And if they don't understand it, how is that communal? So like that is just like a really crazy rabbit hole to go down. But like, that is just a thought I had. And the reason I bring it up is because I would really love to get someone like JJ's really deep knowledge on something like on that.
I don't know if I have any particular insights on it, but I will say this. I remember as a kid growing up and we had,
corded,
did y'all have cordless phones? Okay.
Fancy.
Yeah. Okay. So I remember holding a cordless phone in my hand and going, why can't I take this with me away from the house and still get phone calls? And I tried it. I snuck the phone in my pocket. Of course, it was a huge pocket, but I took it and I was talking on the phone with somebody and about, 300 yards away from the house, it just cut out. And I went, okay, well, I know the answer to that now. As kids, we had none of this convenience. I mean, we had no internet. We had no cell phones. We used maps in order to get around everywhere. We became expert navigators as a result of it. So this idea of the internet, which is now what we live and breathe every single second, didn't exist. So I think you adapt. I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, just because something is so prevalent now doesn't mean that it is vital to the human experience, and it probably hasn't been, you know. That's just,
well, that's a scary concept though, isn't it? Because it's like, if you go to heaven and some people believe that they retain who they are as a person in heaven in that state, but it seems like in order for that to work, you can't have that. You can't have the multiple layers of the things that you enjoyed in regular life, like Chris's pizza or video games or cell phones or whatever, that just goes away. What you're experiencing now as a person and what you enjoy, even if you're like a saint, even if you're someone who really follows your religion to a T, you still have enjoyments and requirements in your life that once you die, they go away, but they're so ingrained as a part of you that when they do go away and you do go to heaven, you kind of lose a big chunk of yourself, so to speak.
Oh, that's not even the worst case scenario. Let's say that you die, you go to heaven, and you don't retain who you are. You just melt into the background. Or this need to worship God is so powerful that you lose all sense of will and self, and you just blend into the background.
I remember hearing about that. Yep.
I'm sure that his glory is heavenly. Don't get me wrong. But I also know that from the prophets in the Hebrew Bible, meeting God always, and I had a Jewish professor was famous for saying this, and I've adopted it ever since. Meeting God is not a good thing. You are going to have a very bad day because his presence is so mind-shatteringly sublime that you are melted in his presence. In fact, it usually takes some form of protection to be able to retain your sense of self in that meeting, whether it's a lump of fire in your mouth to distract you or some other protection. If it was just you, you would be obliterated. Here's an
interesting and crazy, creepy thought. Maybe that is why humanity exists. You know, like we kind of need that, so to speak, trick of the devil or that kind of pulling away from God just enough, like it's a fire in the mouth to where we don't lose ourselves, but we can still appreciate divine. And last thing I'll say, Chris, I saw you lean in. I'll let you talk. But like the last thing I want to say is I remember meeting people who were ultra Christian back when I was leaning into it. And one of the arguments that they brought up was, like you just said, when you do meet God, when you're in heaven, there is nothing else but admiring and praying at the feet of God and Jesus for the rest of eternity. Like that is what heaven is. And honestly, that idea that was injected to me back then was almost equally as terrifying as like a hell.
I had a couple of things, but what you mentioned, JJ, of like, essentially you would just melt away if you if you met God, like your professor saying that's not something you wanted to do. I think it was Moses what saw the back of God and he aged like a zillion years. And I'm exaggerating. He aged like 30 years or something like that, something of that sort. Watch the Ten Commandments. Really good movie, even though Charlton Heston was a douchebag. But very good movie.
You right? Really are the king.
Yul Brynner, great actor. His portrayal of Ramses was amazing. In that concept, it's hard for me to wrap my head around that notion in that sense, because to me, I think when you pass away and your soul leaves your body, wouldn't that put you on some sort of existence in which, Dean, I think we talked about this before, the possibility of when your soul leaves your body, all the knowledge that exists, everything that exists comes back to you. And then you have a full understanding of the universe, the afterlife, heaven, hell, whatever. Wouldn't that be kind of, I'd say, like, really, for lack of better terms, really shitty? Like you die, you go to heaven, you go see God, and all you do is just, you know, prostrate all day. Like you don't, to me personally, heaven, my idea of it would be I would go there and you would meet your creator and him being all loving and all forgiving. And it sounds like this really great parent until you piss him off, which is understandable. That it's someone like you would have like these philosophical conversations with for all eternity. That's something I would hope to do. Like I would ask all of these questions. Like, okay, why is this way? Why is that way? And if the answer is I can't tell you that answer because your whole existence would explode into nothingness because it's too complex, then I understand that. But like you guys said, the whole concept of just going up there, your soul getting there, and then everybody just blends in. Doesn't that defeat the purpose of having free will right now?
Yeah, I see.
I hope I'm not blaspheming. I see what you're saying. But yeah.
No, I think it does. I mean, and if I don't know how much stock you would put into this, but I've interviewed, you know, individuals that have had near-death experiences, people that have been to hell and come back to talk about it. And you find the inverse. I mean, and those are very rare. There's like 3% of all at least documented cases of near-death experiences. And by and far, they are much happier. You know, they go to a bright place. They don't go to a hospital in which it's filled with demons that are aiming to eat them at every stretch of the imagination. But if you take those stories to be real, then you do retain who you are. You do get to see all of your past loved ones, etc. So I don't know. The only thing that I probably can guess is that whatever the answer is, this ultimate mystery in which we have no answer to whatsoever, because think about it, of the billions of individuals who have lived before us, we have no idea what's on the other side of that veil. And I doubt that we ever will. But whatever the answer is, it is probably a crap ton more complex than we could ever imagine. And that's the direction that science is leading us. The more advances we make, the more we realize how complex everything is. I mean, we now, instead of just a classical model of physics, in which that was the end-all be-all, in which people were hypothesizing that, oh yeah, we're going to know everything about physics by the end of the 20th century, no problem at all. And then quantum mechanics became involved, spooky action at a distance, as Einstein called it. We find out that the vacuum of space, even if it's empty, is never empty because of quantum particles that just randomly appear and disappear. Everything is so much more complex than we could ever bloody imagine. And to me, that is nothing but an endless sense of wonder in this world, and just makes me hunger to know more, even if that knowledge is never going to be complete, never going to be enough. It's just the act of learning, which is enough. But that's just a nerd talking to you.
No, that's, I think that's great. And here's a crazy thought that I think is really related to what you just said. And that was a great breakdown. But you know how, like, for instance, in the Hebrew, the Torah leading into the Old Testament, and the Old Testament leading into the New Testament and the New Covenant with God, I always thought about, like, well, okay, if there's a point in human history where there's a new covenant with God, that means that the rules have changed, or something has evolved, something has manifested into another level, that God has created this new degree of understanding, this new covenant with man or humankind or whatever. But going off of what you said, JJ, it's like the discovery about everything that we know, and things that are just constantly unfolding, like the quantum mechanics and stuff like that. We never know what we're going to know next year, let alone 100 years from now. I always wondered, like, well, if there's a progression of religion that the ultimate reality is exposing itself to humanity in different levels, like the Old Testament first and the New Testament, or any other religion you want to equate that to, I always wonder, like, what if there is the true nature of existence as being part of that evolution, that when we do evolve as a human species to that level of in-depth understanding that's way, way beyond what we knew like 1,000 years ago or beyond, that is when the universes or gods or whatever true function of existence will reveal itself. And like call it like the new Testament, you know what I mean? So like, I don't know if that discussion is like very prevalent among religious communities, because you know, the people who are exposed to their religion tend to be confined within that particular bubble of their religion until things change, obviously. But until things change, they stay within that context. So I don't know if anyone's talking about that, like next step beyond in terms of religion. But have you ever come across that? Like either one of you guys, have you ever even come across like a concept of what comes next in terms of religion? And I think we talked about that before we got on.
What I will say is, what you just expressed, this idea that Christianity is an evolution from Judaism, is probably one of the most heinous prejudices that Christianity carries along with it. This idea that it is the true inheritor of the ideas, that you no longer need the 626 laws outlined in the Hebrew Bible, and that you just need to observe the spirit of the law and everything's going to magically become all right. I have some real problems with that viewpoint. It's fine to kind of reevaluate this stuff, but I mean, you have to remember, for centuries after Christ died, there was no Christianity. It was still Judaism. It was just an offshoot of Judaism. And it wasn't until much, much later that people began to recast themselves as an entirely separate and different religion. And it's only then did you begin to get this idea of, oh, we're better than the Jews. And then they begin to castigate, and all of this anti-Semitic ideology erupted into the world. And that's one of the most vile things that humanity has unleashed upon the world, in my opinion. It's just, and I'm not saying this was ever meant to be said in any kind of negative way, but you find this, these ideas kind of embedded in the way that we talk about Christianity now. And it's so easy to step over into that darkness, and you don't even realize that it's happening. Now, that's why, at least in my show, I went to school with a ton of Jews, highly respect them, always have said that if I didn't find redemption through Christ, then I would have become a Jew. And I don't know, I try to observe a lot of the, I always say Hebrew Bible, never say Old Testament, always say BCE and CE rather than BC and AD, just out of respect. Never say the Tetragrammaton, etc. Judaism is still a very, it's still as valid as it ever was in terms of a faith. And I just, I don't want to give into that Christian prejudice that is so common these days, especially with the rise of Christian nationalism in the U.S., which is just probably the most vile thing that has come out, at least within this country, in quite a while.
You're good, anyway, man. We love this.
I'm sorry.
We love when you go on your deep dives. It's really insightful because we don't have the depth of knowledge that you have.
I don't have any depth of knowledge. I just
Harvard, man. My hand, so Harvard. But real quick, the Tetragrammaton. Have y'all seen The Life of Brian? Monty Python's Life of Brian?
Oh, yeah, man.
When they do the stoning.
Oh, dear Lord.
Because the one guy said the word, and then everybody starts saying it.
Actually, do you know that we still don't really know the Tetragrammaton? We have no idea. Now, that's how it used to be pronounced, and you still find that pronunciation all over the place. But now, most scholars, at least in academic circles, will say it's not J, it's YHWH, and they'll say it in a very certain way. But yeah, that's really based upon the 72 letters that made up God's original name that was lost with the destruction of the first temple. So we had the first four letters. That's so really about
72
it.
Letters. That's how they gonna fit on? Yeah, how they gonna fit it on a driver's license, man? That's
a mouthful. I am equally as guilty of that hubris that I spoke about, because who needs an outsider, a goyim, to say that, oh, your faith is equally as valid? That is the most condescending shit. I cannot believe that I said that, and I'm thinking back on it, and I'm just kind of like shaking my head. So it's true for everybody. It doesn't matter what walk of life you are, what faith you are, you will step in it no matter which direction you happen to go in. And that is just my life, and I have come,
you know,
to,
it's hard
that,
nowadays, so. Though, too, like from that perspective, trying to like walk on eggshells, and I feel like that's what our society is at right now. But the one thing you got to remind yourself, even if we cut this out, is it comes from a good place. You know, like you're constantly trying to couch any misunderstanding, which is a really just misfortunate reflection of where we're at as a society. But don't ever forget, man, like you are completely genuine in everything you talked about. And the fact that you even brought up that consideration means you're leaps and bounds ahead of the average person. So yeah. Good on you, man.
I wish I was. I am not. That is the one thing that I will always be cognizant of, because no one puts on their pants any different than one leg at a time. Doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or not. So, and I'm as poor as they come. So. But going into another concept I wanted to bring up is this idea of honoring the dead, which is really kind of where Halloween grew up out of, is prevalent almost in any culture that you happen to go to. I mean, speaking of Japan, Obon, which happens in the very end of summer. And this is actually what one of the reasons why people tell ghost stories and go on tests of courage during the summer months. It is the scary time. It's not the dark time like what we consider it as. It's the time in which it's the brightest outside. It's the hottest. And yeah, it's fascinating. In fact, you find that people make these little animal sculptures out of vegetables, whether they be kuri, cucumber, or eggplant, or whatever, but they're put little four sticks in them, and they make them into little animals, and they're usually left on shrines in order to not ward off evil spirits, but rather to celebrate the dead, and to give them mounts to ride upon, and food to eat. And I love the idea of having a personal altar in your house to your family members in which you dedicate food every day to the dead in order to appease them. This is a beautiful concept.
You know what would be really creepy? If you set up that altar like you just mentioned and you're leaving food out and the next morning it was gone and you don't have any pets or rodents. Fucking terrifying. Fucking terrifying.
That would be. But hey, that's better than what they used to do in Fayum, which is a region of Egypt. They had the most advanced art style known. They had portraitures done before you died, usually in your youth. And you would hang them up in your house. And then when a person died, you would take them back to an artist and they would paint celestial jewelry on you to indicate that you have died. And you would take the mummy back home with you for a year and you would wheel it out to the dinner table when you eat your meals and it would have the portrait taped to their head. And you honored the dead for a year. And these Fayum mummies, they're beautiful portraits. In fact, it looks like the paintings look like they came out of Victoria, England. They are that advanced.
I was going to say that yeah. Story is like not compared to, say, like the Old West where they would take pictures of the dead bodies inside the caskets. But then when you're like, oh, they wheel them out to dinner every night. I'm like, oh, no, that beats it. That way. That's the winner every night.
But have y'all been to funerals where people actively take photographs?
Yeah, I went to a funeral and there were people taking pictures of the person in the coffin and it made me really uncomfortable. I'll just leave it as that. I'm not going to out anybody.
Interesting. But
now that you mentioned the whole thing of they would like take the mummies back home with them, it reminds me I was watching a documentary. It was on Netflix about death and customs of death and this ties into the like our Halloween special about, you know, honoring the dead and whatnot. But there is this culture, I forget in what East Asian country, but they actually dig up their relatives and like change their clothes and give them jewelry and whatnot. I forget where they do that, but I found that really fascinating. They would like talk to them and like update them on their lives, give them new clothes, give them food.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating to see that this thing, this whole concept of honoring the dead is not something that is just solely married to Halloween or like the Western world or Western cultures per se.
That's amazing because I'm surprised that culture lasted. There is such a taboo against touching the dead. And it makes total sense because corpses are nothing but bacteria farms. And this is why Judaism outlawed touching the dead long, long ago. In fact, if you ever did find yourself coming in contact with the dead, you had to become purified by having the ashes of a red heifer sprinkled over you. Yeah, that I have never heard of a culture that did that.
The Indonesian Taroja or Taroha tribe. They mummify and preserve the dead bodies of the deceased. And well after the dead bodies are buried, they'll dig up the grave once a year to meet their deceased relatives.
Yeah, my travels to Indonesia, I never heard of that because Indonesia is predominantly Muslim and they have a lot of taboos about death and the dead and stuff like that. Like, I think one of the prevailing beliefs in Islam is you have to bury your dead on the day they die before sundown, or like there's some serious ramifications if you don't wrap them and bury them by sundown, like you're setting them up for failure in the next life. So I got to look into that. That's actually, I wonder even if they're, I mean, there's a Buddhist contingent in Indonesia that sounds more Buddhist than Islamic, but it could also be like, you know, regional history kind of bleeding into religion. What did you call them again?
Taroja. It's Taroja.
Taroja.
So that's the name of that tribe that does that, which is really interesting. But one thing I wanted to bring up, I think we're getting close to time here. I think we've taken up enough of your time for tonight, JJ, which we really appreciate. But the concept, I randomly thought of this when we were talking about heaven, hell, the devil, and demons. And I was thinking of a way like that being tied back to Halloween. Now, humor my crazy conspiracy theory type of thought. What if Halloween is a mechanism of the dark side, like dark side, Darth Vader? No, but like that mechanism to trick people into doing what they're doing with the, you know, the dressing up as monsters and dressing up as demons and having them focusing on warding off these spirits or worrying about these spirits. And like you mentioned earlier with the soul cakes, like thinking that, correct me if I'm wrong, but like you bake these soul cakes and that's somehow like a stand in for someone else's soul. I don't know why.
Then I think the devil, because who else would not love being able to go out and buy a skeleton with light up eyes and just keep that in their house all year long?
Right? It's evil.
You're evil.
Yeah, for your listeners, he just pulled up a skeleton with glowy eyes, which is great. But yeah, that whole theory, it just sounds bonkers, but the whole concept, you know, the evil spirits and whatnot influencing people into doing that type of shit.
I feel like in order to buy into that, you'd have to go back through human history and all the different religions and all the different layers and say like, well, why is it not synonymous across all of humanity? Why are only some evil spirits giving power over some people who believe in Halloween or Christianity or whatever? Like, you know what I mean? So it's like, I wouldn't get too caught up on that worry.
Yeah. The only reason I bring it up is because you see these outlandish claims made about Halloween. And even with, like, I know this isn't related to Halloween, but even I know when Pokemon was getting popular in the late 90s, in the mid 90s, you've had certain Catholic priests in certain countries essentially demonizing it, saying like this is the work of Satan and the devil. So I view it in that same vein.
That's kind of a offshoot of the satanic panic that really dominated in the 80s more so than any time else. Dear Lord, D&D was of the devil. Everything was of the devil. And you couldn't escape it. I mean, heck, I'm not going to go into that, but you know, I had family members actually, because I like to play D&D, told me I'm going to go to hell because you like playing that devil's game.
Yeah, come on. You know, it's funny. I was going through YouTube and I was trying to look up like interviews with like exorcists and stuff like that. And when you do that, you kind of land on the super uber evangelical side of some of these interviews, and they were talking about D&D and Baldur's Gate 3 and the dangers of, you know, you're like invoking a spirit of something. It's like, no, I'm creating a character. I'm not invoking a spirit. I'm not calling in freaking Beelzebub. I'm not calling in Asmodeus to be my freaking paladin. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Like, I feel like they people always try to demonize everything just because they don't like it. And that's the only reason I could think of, is that just because you don't like it, or you had some sort of bad experience with it, or someone brainwashed you into thinking that it's bad. Because at the end of the day, to me, Halloween, yes, it has its pagan origins with the Celts, even with the Romans. And, you know, the whole concept of honoring your dead, which to me, that's kind of what it is. Well, nowadays for me, it's, you know, to get full size chocolate bars if you go to the nice neighborhoods.
if you can afford it, it comes right back.
There's the full circle. Right.
It's just in that same type of thing. Like, with these holidays, they just, you know, deem it as paganism and stuff like that. I think it's evolved to the point where it's just silly fun for kids. It's not necessarily the same thing as it was, depending on where you go.
The last thing I was going to say is you can never tell what effect the smallest of changes can have. And to me, this is one of the vast benefits of America, is the fact that we are a true melting pot, minus the racism, which is, you know, still rampant, but we've incorporated all of these different traditions and ideals into our culture. And who would have ever thought that Irish settlers coming over and bringing over some of their All Hallows Eve garb in order to, you know, keep away the evil demons would spread into a commercial holiday, which everybody in the world celebrates. I mean, before, even in Japan, no one had heard of Halloween. And now you go there, it's everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. It actually got them in trouble a couple of years ago because people began to trash cars in Shibuya, which is kind of the fashionable. Have y'all seen in videos the giant crosswalk, which has like a million people that cross at a time? That's Shibuya. That's going right into the fashion district. But anyway, yeah. I mean, it's amazing to think that one small tradition from one little corner of the world was able to spread and morph into something that we have today. And we never know what effect something that we incorporate is going to have. And to me, that is just a beautiful consequence of living in a world that is always changing and always evolving, even faster now with the amount of connectedness that we all particularly have through the internet.
Happy Halloween, everyone. You're not going to go to hell for trick-or-treating. So enjoy your candy. Take your kids out. Have a good time. And remember, don't be a dick.
Absolutely. Candy bars.
Thanks for tuning into today's episode of The Wandering Road. You can find us on Apple, Google, Spotify, and most podcast platforms. Be sure to subscribe and share. Also, don't forget to give a follow on Instagram at @twroadpodcast and follow my TikTok at @twrpodcast. Take care, and I'll catch you on the next one.